Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for Monday, May 19th, 2008, and on this episode we have an interview with director Jason Moore. He'll be talking to Tom Williams about Avenue Q, which will be finally here in Chicago. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago, and let's talk theater.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our guest this week is Jason Moore, who is the director of the much-anticipated show that has never been shown in Chicago but will open on the 21st, Avenue Q, which is a Tony Award-winning musical that I think is terrific. I have not seen the show, but I've listened to the score over and over again. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me today.
Great. Tell us now, for our Chicago audiences who have not seen the show unless they ventured to New York or to Las Vegas, tell us about Avenue Q.
Avenue Q is a story, it's a sort of classic story for a musical, really, about a young man who moves to New York to sort of find his dream and find his purpose in life. And in a nutshell, the twist on our show, I think, is that young man happens to be a puppet.
Wow. That's
the most succinct way I know to say it. It gets a lot more complicated from there.
Okay.
But I think it's a really sweet, very wickedly funny, sort of moving story, and ultimately moving story about a group of people who live on Avenue Q, which is a place where you live way, way outside of Manhattan because you can't even afford Avenue A. You have to be on Avenue Q. And, you know, people move to the big city to sort of pursue their dreams, and this is a group of people who are doing that. And the show uses sort of conventions of children's television, puppets and music and songs, to address very adult issues. So instead of learning to tie your shoes, you learn how to deal with racism.
So just to get one thing clear, this is not a children's show.
It's not a children's show, no. It's definitely for adults. It's kind of... There's lots of swear words and lots of really adult ideas. It's about racism and being gay, but it approaches it in a really funny, kind of very subversive way.
And I think it's the humor. I mean, even in those infectious little ditties, the songs. It sounds like, in a way, these guys must have a jingle background. Is that true?
No, they don't have jingle background. I mean, they're songwriters, but I think in a way, you know, the idea of the songs, you know, from like Sesame Street and the Electric Company was that they were simple, that people could sing along with them, and that's how you learned your lessons. That's how you learned your ABCs or your 1-2-3s. But in ours, you know, we learn a little bit more about porn than our ABCs. But that's the convention of the music. But they're really catchy and fun to sing.
Yeah, and so tell us how they're not just puppets. The actors play themselves and they play puppets. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's in the world of, like, on children's television, it's a world where puppets and people and monsters all live in this place called Avenue Q. And, you know, that's the reality that we're sort of putting forth, that puppets live in the real world. But in our show, actually, our actors play several different puppet characters, and the audience gets to see them play all those characters.
Oh, that's interesting. And I know you had some of the songs, like one of my favorites is "It Sucks to Be Me."
Yeah,
that's about what the 32-year-old saying that he's 10 years out of college and he still hasn't made it.
That's sort of our opening number, and it's all the people on Avenue Q who sort of, you know what, they didn't tell me when I was young. They told me I was going to be special and I could do whatever I wanted. But the reality is, you get to be in your late 20s and early 30s, and you go, when's it going to happen? I still got three roommates and playing Xbox all day. You know, this isn't what I planned for my life. So it's sort of about, you know, they're saying it sucks to be me because life hasn't turned out exactly as everyone promised it would.
Yeah, like the one fellow's talking about his BA in English, and he has no skills, so he can't make a living.
Yeah, he got a good education, but what do you do with that piece of paper?
Well, I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Yeah.
I read where one of the reviewers called it a quarter-life crisis. I don't know if you remember that term, but I thought that was terrific.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, a lot of our characters are in their 20s because originally when Bobby and Jeff, the composer lyricist team, wrote it, they were in their, or, you know, mid-20s, and we all kind of were. That was the stage of life we were at where you start asking those questions about, you know, what am I really going to do with my life now that no one has got me on a meal plan and changing my toilet paper for me? You know, and now what do you do? But what I think we came to learn, which I also was quite happy with, that audiences of all ages really enjoyed it, because in a way you're kind of always in a crisis about what you want to do with your life and what's next. And so, you know, that in a way, just because they're in their 20s, it becomes a metaphor for any, you know, major period of your life where things are changing.
Right. And then now this is just so to get the credits out. The book was Jeffrey Witte,
mm-hmm.
and the music and lyrics by Robert Lopez and Jeff Marx.
Right.
And of course you, Jason Moore, are the director. Now tell us how you guys met and how this project got started.
Sure. Well, Bobby and Jeff, the composer lyricist team, met in the BMI Music Theater Workshop. And, you know, there are lots of people out there who are sort of cynical about musicals. They don't really buy that people burst out into song. And that's one of the problems, I think, sometimes with musical theater, is that people think it's an archaic form, you know. And they were children of children's theater and of animated musicals. And they thought, you know what, who do we write songs for that people would believe, and that way they would believe, and the first thing they thought of was, you know what, we feel comfortable as a generation and sort of as Americans with puppets singing. That's something most of us grew up on. So that's where they got the idea to start writing songs for puppets. And frankly, it was funny to hear the puppets talk about grown-up stuff, and that was sort of the basis of the idea for what became in the very end the musical.
It's a very clever idea. And I interviewed Maury Yeston a while back, and he said that he thought he named you guys as being the talents that he's worked with at the workshop.
Well, yeah, Maury came in. We were at the O'Neill Theater Music Theater Conference, which is a really great sort of, you know, getaway writer's retreat where you get to work on the material, and then they sort of bring in more seasoned professionals to sort of give you help and notes. And Maury was one of the people that sat down with us, which was very helpful.
Yeah, and he said that you guys were one of the best crews he's ever worked with. He said they were just amazing.
Oh, that's great. You know, we all cared. We were all working on the show as it being our first big show that we were doing together. So it's a real bonding experience to go through that together.
So now Avenue Q is this little, cute little show that opens up off Broadway in a small house. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And tell us how it emerged to end up knocking out Wicked. That's quite a story. Tell us.
It's a long journey. Well, I mean, the sort of the early stages, even before that, was when originally the guys actually wrote the songs for television, like, you know, like a Sesame Street or an Electric Company on TV, but it dealt with adult issues. And the producers, Jeffrey, Kevin, and Robin, saw the material and thought this would make a great musical on stage. So they brought in Jeff Witte to write the book, and eventually me to help shape it, to take the songs that they had written for these great characters and weave a story out of them and write more songs. And eventually we went to the O'Neill Workshop, and eventually that became the show that people know as Avenue Q. We opened at the Vineyard, I guess, a year later after the workshop, and the Vineyard, I think, seats 149 people. And the response was overwhelming, really. Even in those little audiences, people were sort of responding with laughter. You know, were sort of beside themselves in a way that we, frankly, didn't expect. Because in some ways, we kind of wrote this for ourselves, because we were, again, in our 20s and 30s and kind of writing what we knew. And it really hit a chord with people. Wow. And then we got good reviews, sort of, you know, from lots of, you know, what people would say, important people. And then the producers decided to move it to Broadway, which was a place that people said we dare not go.
That must be scary.
You know, it was exciting. I think anybody who tells you they don't want to have a show on Broadway is lying to you. So when we set out, as scary as it was also kind of a dream come true. Everybody, you know, who works on musicals are kind of a Broadway, you know, beast. And so the idea, even though it was a little show and kind of an unusual show, it would be different on Broadway. We were really excited by it, and emboldened by the experience that we had in front of audiences that were of all ages and types.
Yeah, because it was originally marketed for, like, what was it, 15 to 40?
Yeah, it was sort of more about the early stages, people who, you know, were in the early stages of their lives and career. But, you know, the main story is a guy looking for his purpose in life. And it's been really interesting over the years to have people who, you know, a woman in her 50s who's just gotten divorced, and she says, you know what, I have a new life now, and I'm looking for my purpose in life. Or someone who's retiring and changing careers, and they're looking for their purpose in life. And you come to realize that that basic existential journey of trying to figure out where you are and what you want to do next is something that everyone experiences of all ages. And I think that was the big secret that we weren't able to unlock until we realized we had big audiences to tell us that.
Well, that shows that when you follow your heart and you're truthful, that look what can happen.
Yeah, to be specific, to be universal.
So now you're in an 800-seat house on Broadway, and you're going up against shows like Wicked. And I remember seeing that documentary that was done.
Show Business?
Yeah, well, that was a terrific documentary, and how everyone was sort of concluding, well, Wicked's got to win, and then you guys kind of snuck up on them, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, it still is amazing to me to this day. We were all, again, so thrilled just to be on Broadway at all, and then the thrill of actually being nominated for a Tony is so much in and of itself. And we thought it basically would end there because there were so many other good shows, Wicked, Carolina Change, that were up that year, and so many people, you know, who have such a great body of work that we were flattered to be among them. And then we got there all having had a few drinks because we didn't think we would have to talk in front of people. And then Jeff won the Tony, and we thought, oh, this might be something different than we expected.
So you won for Best Musical.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't you win for Book, Music, and Lyrics?
Yeah, music. But Jeff, Bobby, and Jeff all won Tonys for the writing.
Well, and I know you're modest, but you were also nominated for director.
I was, yes.
That
didn't win, though.
Well.
But that's all right. The show won, and that really is, you know, when the show wins, sort of everybody is getting a reward, which is great.
Yeah, and it's kind of ironic when you can say I directed a Tony Award winning show. That's got to be
it's a privilege.
Yeah. So all right. So now the show is a hit in New York, and then we were all waiting for the tour, and then it took kind of a strange twist. It ended up in Vegas. Tell us how that happened.
Well, they had been talking about it, you know, getting the tour out and trying to figure out what that would be. And one of our producers had strong relationships with people in Las Vegas. And Vegas was sort of, they had opened Phantom there, I guess. And it was sort of, a lot of casino owners were sort of trying to do like a Broadway West idea. And we were really the next show, I guess. No, it was Mamma Mia that was already there. Sorry.
Right, Mamma Mia. And I think Phantom was going to open or did.
Yeah, and we were sort of the next. And so we were sort of at the head of that wave idea. And they were so aggressive and offered us such an interesting, fascinating situation to be there that the producers decided that's where we would go next. And we opened there. And I think ultimately what happened over that time and over the last few years is that Broadway West really isn't working very well out there, that people in Las Vegas want to go see shows that are, you know, shorter and less language-based and have a lot more acrobatics than anything Avenue Q ever had. But you know what? The show, actually, the audiences that saw it there loved it. We were also in a really big theater.
I had talked to some people that said probably the reason it didn't work initially is because people didn't know the show, that the shows that work in Vegas are those that have toured, and everyone knows it, and they go to Vegas, and they want to see it again.
Yeah, and actually, the thing that's been the surprising outcome of that is a version of what you just explained, which is now that we didn't go on tour right away, the show has been around longer, and now that we're on tour, the response has been overwhelming and sold out. And I think that's because people, over time, get to know the title of the show and get curious about it, and maybe if we had gone out right away, we wouldn't have had as much recognition as we have. So it's kind of worked out, you know,
interesting,
great,
yeah,
in all ways.
Yeah, and the anticipation, I know, here in Chicago has been very strong. And a lot of people have the soundtrack because it is one of the – it's a terrific soundtrack. You don't have to know the show. You kind of know the show just listening to the soundtrack.
Yeah, I think it gives you a sense of the tone of the show because sometimes it's hard to explain to people, like – you know, they're puppets, but they're talking in curse words. What is this about? I don't get it.
Yeah, and songs like Internet is for Porn and Everyone's a Little Bit Racist.
Yeah, I think those song titles kind of give you clues like, oh, I get it, sort of, you know, funny, keen observations about the way the world works.
But it certainly comes off, even with these songs, it comes off with a lot of heart and a lot of charm.
Good. I think that's the other sort of thing we really strove to do, and I'm in a way most proud of, is that it is sort of funny and wacky, but in the end, you know, the thing I'm always most thrilled with is when you feel that the audience is moved. I always feel like audiences go to the musical theater to see things that make them laugh and that make them cry, and I think we're able to offer a little of both, so it's...
Well, it's lots of humor. I mean, I laugh every time I hear it, and I'm not, you know, I'm only in one dimension right now until I see the show next Wednesday here in Chicago. Let me just throw a little commercial in for it. It will be at the Cadillac Palace. It opens May 21st and runs through June 7th. And as I said, I have not seen anticipation for a show as high as it is for this show. We just can't wait to see it.
Well, that's great. I'm thrilled. You know, I went to Northwestern, and Chicago is my favorite theater city, so it's an honor to sort of be back there.
Yeah, and it was amazing how many shows you know, start here before they go to New York, but who knew where your show was going to go, right? At that point, yeah. And it was developed in New York, so it had to go that route.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. How working with a new, being a director and working with brand new material, tell us something about the process of that, because we have a lot of directors who listen to these podcasts. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing to take a, you know, reinterpret Company,
mm-hmm.
but it's totally other game when you're with brand new material.
Yeah, you're sort of forging into the unknown, and it's why I like doing it with new plays and musicals, is because you really are solving something for the first time and telling a story for the first time, and that can be sort of terrifying because there's no map ahead of you, but it's also what can be so thrilling in the end. But especially on a musical, because there are so many collaborators, and you know, like on Avenue Q, I was aboard before the script was written, and on Shrek, I was aboard even before the composer was around. You know, you're looking to find the most integrated situation that you can, where the book inevitably leads to a song, which inevitably has a certain kind of lyric, which inevitably looks a certain way, and you're sort of, you know, making you're benchmarking what the show is. And it takes a lot of trial and error to do that. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of songs that got thrown out of Avenue Q, a lot of jokes that got thrown out of Avenue Q. And it's sort of trial and error. And then you get to this point where you're happy, the four of you in your living room making each other laugh, and it seems to work. And then, of course, you have to put it in front of an audience. And then the audience tells you what's working, and it's a constant reshaping. You can't get precious about anything, because musicals are kind of wily, strange beasts. Sometimes they work for a reason you can't explain, and other times they fail for a similar reason. So, you know, it's a real trial and error business, I think.
As a director, how much input do you have with the book writers? And, you know, I mean, how does, are you the final arbitrator, or?
You know, I think we always had a rule on Avenue Q is that we wouldn't move forward on any, you know, ideas unless we all agreed. So it was kind of a checks and balances system that we all felt like everything we were doing was either funny or a good idea for whatever reason. And I think when you have the best kind of collaborations, everyone's working on everything. Because, again, when a musical, everything's so integrated, it's hard to separate the book from the music. You know, in the best worlds, they seem like they fit together perfectly. So in some ways, the job, is arbitrating and it's guiding. But that's the way I like to do it. That's why I like to be aboard early, because shaping the story is everything, and where the songs come in a musical is everything, and the style that they're told in is everything about a musical. And so, you know, getting in on those early decisions hopefully yields a better, you know, result.
I think that's a modern trend, because I remember researching some of the old classics where the director was the last guy brought in.
Often that was the case, because the writer was sort of the top of the pyramid and let in. But, you know, when you got into more concept musicals with Hal Prince and Michael Bennett, and where the way that it was staged and presented was inextricably linked to the way that it was written, then I think directors started to become more of the collaborative process of shaping the event of the musical. And as the shape and style of musicals changed in the 60s and 70s in particular, then they, you know, people were looking for new forms and ways to tell the stories. And then I think that's where this more modern trend of having a director aboard early is more secure.
Well, I think it serves productions well. And, of course, it helped that you guys are all of the same generation in this particular case, right?
Yeah, we were all coming from a similar place. This was all our first sort of big job, and a lot of us were working other jobs to pay the bills. And going through that experience together is part of what makes you trust one another and collaborate in the best way, because really there's not a lot of ego, but there's a lot of dreaming going on, which helps.
Yeah, and you've directed all the productions of this show so far?
I've directed all the ones in English.
Okay.
There are several productions throughout the world, in Tel Aviv and Manila and all these different places. I've not directed those, but
is that right? Mm-hmm. How is it working in other cultures?
You know, apparently it's kind of, I think it's like very dependent on how much the other cultures are familiar with American television. Because again, the whole concept of this show really comes from the tradition of children's television: Sesame Street, Electric Company, Mr. Rogers. And if people don't have that same tradition in their culture, I think it's just confusing, frankly.
Yeah.
And so in some cultures, it's been a huge, phenomenal success. In others, I think people, it's just been a curiosity.
Yeah. How did the London production go?
It's going great, actually. It's just starting its third year. I was just over there. We were recasting our company for the third time.
Did you direct that, too?
I did, yeah.
Oh, good. So that really leaves you hands-on, and you did the Vegas production, now you're doing the tour.
And I did the tour, yeah.
Tell us about some of the cast members that are on the tour, and you know, and how many of them are, you know, been with the project a while, or any of them from the original cast?
None of them are from the original cast right now, but that Vegas company that I talked about, you know, that was our sort of second company, and that's when we really scoured the nation, literally, in several different cities for the best people for that company, because our original cast was the people who had done the workshop for so long and the people who had been on Sesame Street and who had sort of come from the world of puppetry. But the Vegas company was our next big push to find the best actors that could do the comedy and the singing and the dancing and then teach them to puppeteer, which was a long, arduous process. Then when the Vegas company closed, we actually had an incredible set of actors. So some of these people are people from the Vegas company, and some of them were people who actually played the parts on Broadway. And we really wanted to assemble the finest tour that we had. And so we've been able to sort of handpick a lot of our best alums and then a couple of new fresh people to really have a company that I'm very, very pleased and proud of. That's a pretty great group. It's a hard show to do. Puppetry is one of those things that when it's done well, it looks kind of easy, and when it's done poorly, it just looks like hell. So, you know, they're quite skilled and facile.
And that was the challenge, finding people that were comfortable doing all those, including the puppetry.
Yeah, because you sort of find, we would find people who could sing and act and dance all the parts, and they're playing multiple parts, don't forget. So they're
right,
playing the ingenue and the vixen all at once. And then you put a puppet on an actor's arm, and everything can really go awry. So it's a real special skill, someone who can do all of those things and sort of, you know, basically do it on point with a puppet.
So how long a process was that? All right, you find the people. These people are terrific. I want to use them. Now you got to teach them the puppetry. How long is that process?
We have puppet school and puppet camp. We have puppet.
Do you really?
Yeah, and we puppet school is to sort of teach our actors the basics and see who is going to excel. And then puppet school is when they actually get hired. We send them. We have a week of just training. I mean, if anything, you just have to train your muscles. Holding something in the air for 8 hours a day in rehearsal can be crippling.
And
if
these
you don't
are
do it right.
From the photos I've seen, these are pretty good sized puppets.
Yeah, they're not just sock puppets. They're you know, like you know, puppets like a lot like the Jim Henson puppets that are lip sync puppets, we call them, hand and rod lip sync puppets. And so just to train people the basics, and then you have to develop the character and sing the songs. So the rehearsal process is about 6 weeks long, which is sort of normal for a musical, but we add, for the puppeteers only, we add another week on at the beginning just to train their arms and bodies to do this crazy thing that they have to do.
So I understand from what I've read, the tour has been very, very successful.
It has been. It's been a real, it's really, it's surprised us how successful it's been. And, you know, it's already actually rebooking to go back to cities that it's already been through because the demand was so high. So it's been a thrill and an honor, really.
Wow, that's terrific. And I know there's been some buzz here that after the tour, I don't know when, but that it's possible for a sit-down production of it here in Chicago.
That would be great. You know, I haven't heard anything about that officially or whatever, but
oh,
that would
either,
be that
but,
would be a dream for,
I know,
for me.
I know a young hot producer in town who really wants the show.
And, you know, Chicago is such a great theater city, and I love going to school there because it was all new work. The Goodman, the Steppenwolf, and all those great companies are doing new plays and new writers, and the Chicago audiences are so smart to know how to look at material like that. I think, you know, Avenue Q, I think, would be a great match for Chicago. So hopefully I'd love to come back and spend 6 weeks in Chicago getting it ready.
Right. So, all right, let's go into some of your background now. You're another one of those Northwestern guys.
Yeah.
I always kid people. I says, you know, I review shows every night, do over 300 a year. And I said, I'll be darned if every time I open up a cast list, there's somebody with a background at Northwestern, just about every show.
Yeah. You know, the year I was there, I graduated in 1993, and the 4 years that I was there, they actually started for the very first time a music theater program, which was a venture between the theater school and the music school. And it's really grown to become, you know, a great program and one that's quite competitive to get in and out of. So I think that you do see more and more well-trained music theater performers, particularly, and also some behind-the-scenes people. It's really become, you know, a real place to birth music theater people.
Yeah, well, we love them, and that speaks highly. So you'd recommend Northwestern for someone who's really into musical theater?
I loved it there. You know, I also was in the film program, and they have a great performance studies program where Frank Galati and Mary Zimmerman used to teach, based in text, which is also a very, you know, tried and true Chicago tradition. So they offer a lot of modes of performance, which I think are very helpful for all skill sets in the theater.
Yes. So let's tell us about what you have going. I've noticed in your credits you've written for television, Dawson's Creek and One Tree Hill.
Yeah, I've actually directed for television episodes of that and Brothers and Sisters. I actually went into Northwestern as a film major. I've always had an interest in both film and theater and straight plays and musicals, so kind of a bit schizophrenic in that way, I guess, or ADD or something. But, you know, I spent some time in Los Angeles working on movies and for film directors, and then I kind of missed the theater, so I moved back to New York. And while I was in New York working in the theater, I actually missed film, and so I started getting jobs working in television just to kind of keep that side of my skill set going. And I got to work on some really great shows with some fun actors. So it's always something I kind of keep alive because I'd like to make a film someday.
Well, you have some big shows coming up. Give us an idea of a couple of the shows you have coming up.
Well, I have the one that's the most right on the forefront. We start rehearsal in about 4 weeks, is Shrek the Musical for DreamWorks, which is something I've actually been working on for about 4 years with the writers and, of course, the designers, and now this incredible company which we've assembled. So it's a long birthing process for a musical, so I'm so excited to get in the rehearsal room and actually make the thing after having talked about it for so long.
Yeah. So you have these urges. You're among a lot of the young talents that love film and love theater and can do both, and I don't see a problem with that.
Well, that's good because sometimes it confuses people, you know, but I like to do both. You know, more and more, I think directors in particular, whether it's Sam Mendes or Rob Marshall, Kathleen Marshall, it's more common for directors to sort of go back and forth between film and theater. People are starting to see the connections.
Well, Fosse did it. And
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's not like it, but you have to sort of understand both quite a bit, and obviously you do to have those interests and to have the success you've had.
Yeah, and you have to enjoy it. I think, you know, I know a lot of theater directors who, you know, theater is so exciting and immediate and visceral, and you're in a rehearsal room working 8 hours a day, and film is a lot of waiting around, so the pace is quite different, and so if you don't enjoy it, there's no point in doing it. But I actually I've liked changing it up. I get kind of bored doing the same thing again and again, so I like changing the mode that I'm working in.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have any plans? Do you guys have any plans to do another puppet musical?
No, not the Avenue Q team. It's funny now. Anything that has puppets in it, I usually get a call about it, which makes me laugh because I didn't start out working in puppets. I learned how to work with puppets on Avenue Q, but no more puppet musicals per se. I think that was the one we had in us.
Yeah, and let's hope people don't just, you know, the imitators don't start trying to do it thinking it's a gimmick, because I think it only works in certain shows.
Yeah, I think it kind of hits a certain kind of zeitgeist that we did. But, you know, puppets are such theatrical instruments. They are, and they're the kind of things that you can, that, you know, are abstractions and theatrical. So I hope people keep using them in sort of populist forms of entertainment, because I think they can allow you to do things that you can't do anywhere else, and that's what the theater should be doing.
Yes, it should. Well, congratulations on your success, and it's always great to talk to somebody who really is excited about what they do and really enjoys doing it.
Thanks. Yeah, I do love it. I feel lucky to be able to go in every day and work with all these great actors and designers. It's thrilling.
Well, thank you for Avenue Q, and we can't wait. And folks, remember, you got to see this show. It's really a hoot. It's funny, it's smart, and I think you'll be thoroughly entertained. So thank you for listening.
Thanks.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of May 19th, 2008. Steppenwolf Theater Company's critically acclaimed August, Osage County, has been nominated for 7 2008 Tony Awards, including Best Play, Best Direction, and Best Leading Actress. This has been a stellar season for August Osage County. Other awards include the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for Drama, which was given to playwright Tracy Letts. They've also received 3 2008 Outer Critics Circle Awards and 6 Joseph Jefferson Awards, including Best Production for a Play and Best Ensemble. Also in the Tony Awards spotlight is Chicago Shakes. They have been awarded the 2008 Regional Theater Tony Award, which is a special Tony Award given to a regional theater company in the United States. The 2008 Tony Awards will be broadcast live on Sunday, June 15th at 7 p.m. For more information, go to TonyAwards.com or, of course, click on over to Theater in Chicago's news website. Producer Walter Stearns has announced the plans to open the Lincoln Park Theater in the fall of 2009. The new theater will be located in the former Fullerton State Bank building, which will undergo a multi-million dollar renovation to become a 299-seat state-of-the-art proscenium theater and gallery space. Not only that, it's been announced that Porchlight Music Theater will be the first company in residence. Chicago architect John Morris, whose previous designs include Steppenwolf Theater and Looking Glass Theater, is set to design the space, which he calls a jewel box of a theater. The new Lincoln Park Theater will feature a main floor and a balcony for the audience. The space is configured in a traditional proscenium arrangement, which will include an orchestra pit, a fly loft to move the scenery, and an oversized stage footprint. However, there will be only 10 rows of audience seating, which should create an intimate experience. Porchlight Music Theater, which is very well known here in Chicago, has already received a total of 24 Joseph Jeff Award nominations, and of which they've taken home 10. This move will definitely take the company to a whole new level of influence on the Chicago theater scene. Stay tuned to Talk Theater in Chicago as the opening date draws near. Hedy Weiss, theater critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, is hosting a new video web chat session direct from the Sun-Times newsroom. The show is called Stage Right with Hedy Weiss, and it airs on Thursdays at 3:30 p.m. You can check it out on ustream.tv. Hedy will be discussing recent openings to shows, She'll also be recommending shows, give updates on recent Chicago premieres, and answer some theater-related questions sent in by viewers live on the air. There have already been some shows made. You can check out the past clips at ustream.tv. That, of course, is for free. Ustream is like an interactive version of YouTube. It allows users to create broadcasts and discussions, performances, announcements, and receive instant feedback through live video feeds. For more information, click on over to Theater in Chicago's news website. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago news podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago. And I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Jason Moore for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.